Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If not jobs, then what? If not a housing recovery now, then when? Where, oh, where is the recovery going to come from? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 27th of September. Good to have you with us. This has been the summer of our economic discontent. Recession, made worse by stock market turmoil and political stalemate. So one reads the daily statistical tea leaves fairly closely, looking for something to hang on to. And there was a glimmer today. The S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index for 20 big U.S. cities was up 0.1% in July, though down from a year ago. Consumer confidence was up last month, though lower than it was this spring. So we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman off this morning with this assignment. Hey, Mitchell, find us some good news, will ya?
Here's how recessions usually end. The government keeps interest rates really low to spur growth, and that makes it easier to buy a house. Builders start breaking ground. They hire construction workers. Well, interest rates sure are low right now, but that's about the only thing in this script that's gone right, says Paul Dales at Capital Economics.
The problem is that low interest rates aren't really much comfort when households aren't able to qualify for a loan. So that means during this economic recovery, residential investment has added nothing to economic growth at all.
Consumer spending is a major driver of the economy. Couldn't consumers step up?
Consumers are spending on needs and not desires. In addition, inflation is up, so they're actually paying more and getting less.
Economist Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight says consumers are in a state of high anxiety over gridlock on Pennsylvania Avenue and turmoil on Wall Street.
And there's nowhere they can turn to, not the job market, not increasing their housing wealth. And now equity markets are not doing well, so they're taking another hit.
But big companies are doing pretty well. They cut costs and workers in the recession, and now profits are rolling in. Can't we look to them for some economic love?
Companies are now sitting on a record $2 trillion cash. That money is essentially idle.
That's Bernard Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group.
And given the political paralysis in Washington and how everyone is revising down growth for the future, there's really not much of an incentive to tap those idle reserves and hire more workers.
Baumol says big companies are doing well exporting. They just don't need many additional U.S. workers to do that. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said today he's going to bring a bill to the floor of the Senate next week that goes after Beijing for manipulating its currency. Just the latest indicator that there are those in Washington and elsewhere who say we're not getting all we could from our trading relationship with China. Gordon Hanson is an economist at the University of California, San Diego, whose most recent research says exactly that. Gordon Hanson, good to have you with us.
My pleasure to be with you, Kai.
Conventional wisdom has it that trade is, in essence, good, and trade with China, while painful, is positive, and you're not disputing that. But there's a downside here that we haven't really thought about.
There is, and it's something that economists have been uncovering slowly over time. It doesn't often get a great deal of attention because people like to tell the good news story about international trade, but there are consequences for workers who are in the front line of international competition.
Lay them out. You and your colleagues went and surveyed every county in the United States, right, for its exposure to Chinese trade.
If you look across U.S. regions, different parts of the country produce very different types of goods. You're worse off in certain parts of North Carolina, certain parts of Tennessee. It's the southern Midwest and kind of northern Southeast that have taken the brunt of this impact. But that said, the impact of China trade has really been felt nationally. Here in San Diego, where I live, we've lost sporting goods industries as a result of Chinese competition. Callaway golf clubs, which used to be made right here in Carlsbad, are now made in China.
And when you are exposed, what happens?
Larger reductions in manufacturing employment, larger increases in the fraction of your population that is unemployed, and ultimately that what that leads to is greater uptake of government benefits of various types.
And the commensurate increases taxes that we have to pay for those, right?
Correct.
Is there a way for us to know what trade with China is costing us? I mean, yes, there's a net benefit, but there are significant downsides, right? Do we know how big those downsides are?
We have a sense. So the benefits from China we're estimating are on the order of $100 per capita in the United States.
Okay.
So we're talking about efficiency losses associated with government benefits that are on the order of $25 to $30 per capita. And so you say that $100 savings we got from making purchases at Walmart,
yeah,
well, we're going to lose $25, $30 of that associated with a tax liability we might face today, we might face somewhere down the line.
Is this research that says trade with China is bad and we ought not do it?
Absolutely not. As economists, you're sort of beholden to the idea that free trade is good because it increases global efficiency.
Yeah.
But to get people to buy into that notion, you have to convince them that if they're going to take it on the chin, there's going to be something there to help them make adjustments. And so what we've got to think about is a set of public policies that help workers who are on the front line of competition with China move into other sectors and do so in a manner that doesn't impose all the burden on them.
You know, so if you go to China, I mean, I was in Shanghai 2.5-ish months ago, and I've been going repeatedly for the past dozen years. If you're there, you see these changes happening, and you know that something's coming. Did we just not plan for this, or is it happening too fast for us to plan?
Well, we're living through an unusual moment. We don't normally see very large economies go through very rapid adjustment. We've certainly seen economies that have opened themselves to global trade, that have privatized, that have deregulated, like much of China has done. We've seen that before, but never on this scale. That's what's different this time around.
Gordon Hanson is a professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks very much, Kai.
Chelsea Clinton. Yes, that Chelsea Clinton has a new job. It's not one that most people her age would get. She's 31 now. She has joined the board of directors of the big digital media conglomerate IAC Interactive. That's the company behind more than 50 internet brands, you know, including Match.com and The Daily Beast as well. She gets a $250,000 stock grant for her troubles, plus a $50,000 a year retainer. And as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports, investors in IAC will be getting their youngest board member yet.
She's lived most of her life in the public eye, but she doesn't have much experience with public companies. Chelsea Clinton has been a board member for several nonprofits, but now she'll be watching over a company with a market value of nearly $3.5 billion.
In any situation where someone with a well-known name who is well-known and is young goes on a board, the question is, are they there to represent shareholder interest, or are they there for other reasons?
That's Charles Elson, who heads the University of Delaware's Center for Corporate Governance. IAC says Chelsea Clinton's appointment had nothing to do with her family's close personal ties to media mogul Barry Diller, IAC's founder. Diller has supported the presidential campaigns of both her father and mother. And the Financial Times pointed out Chelsea and her mother have often been dressed by fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg, who's Diller's wife. IAC calls Ms. Clinton keenly intelligent and says she'll be a strong contributor. She'll also be the company's youngest board member by 7 years. Again, Charles Elson.
Someone can be young and have lots of experience. Someone can be young and have understanding of the industry in which the company finds itself. The issue isn't youth. The issue is this the right person to be an effective monitor?
Some studies suggest companies often perform better with younger board members. Researchers have found them to be more innovative, technically savvy, and less bound by the status quo. But at GMI Research, Paul Hodgson says he's found it's better if directors are neither too old nor too young.
To be perfectly honest, at the two extremes, the governance issues that were raised by the appointment of both the very old and the very young directors were about the same.
A report from Institutional Shareholder Services found that in the past 4 years, at least 100 people born since 1977 have joined the boards of public companies, four of them when they were just 24. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Just 24? What's the matter with me, man? Holy cow. On Wall Street today, there was some good news from Europe, then some bad news from Europe. Traders reacted accordingly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Department of Energy, should you be curious, gets $3 billion a year for research and development. Today, the DOE said it's going to start spending more of that $3 billion on electric cars than it has in the past. They didn't say this next part directly, but federal budgets being what they are, the extra money for EVs, electric vehicles, comes at the expense of clean energy. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
White House science czar John Holdren opened today's announcement with this news. Plotting a national energy strategy is really hard.
An energy strategy is hard because there is no single silver bullet. We're going to need a broad mix of technologies and a broad mix of strategies.
True enough, but the Department of Energy released a report today that chastised itself for underinvesting in cleaner transportation, like electric vehicles, advanced biofuels, and surprisingly, improving the internal combustion engine. The DOE wants to focus on reducing the nation's oil dependence, and energy scholar Michael Levy notes technologies that can speed up that reduction.
A big part of what drives this shift to a focus on vehicles and fuels is a desire to have an impact over the next decade or so.
And yes, in tech circles, a decade is speedy. Former DOE economist Peter Morici argues the shift spells less government dollars for clean electricity in the future. The DOE is already under fire over its failed investment in Solyndra, the bankrupt solar company. And Morici argues the new strategy just happens to play well into the president's reelection.
After all, it throws some assistance in the direction of the automobile industry and away from, say, solar panels and so forth, which are not unionized.
Still, says Michael Levy, it's far from a backdoor stimulus program for car makers.
I cannot imagine that people in Detroit are looking at this and saying this is our way out of our current problems.
Along with cleaner transportation, the DOE also wants to direct more money towards modernizing the nation's aging power grid. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
IMDb, the Internet Movie Database. It's pretty much the place to go for anything and everything motion picture and entertainment related. IMDb.com gets millions of hits, but parent company Amazon has yet to figure out how to make a profit from it. So today, IMDb unveiled a way to do that by putting all the data in that database to work. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
IMDb's plan begins with a mobile trivia game. There's a celebrity photo match where you try to guess the star in a fuzzy picture or match a movie poster with a film. I tried a few questions with the game's creator, Kenton Brambert. First, I had to identify which movie this quote was from.
You are about to enter another dimension.
I'm going to say The Twilight Zone.
All right.
Once I got the Twilight Zone quote right, I wanted another question and another one. That's the idea. Addiction. The app for iPhones is free at first. It comes with hundreds of questions to answer, but once you've gone through those, you have to pay 99 cents to download more. There will also be some ads at the bottom of your screen. Larry Weber heads the W2 marketing group. He says IMDb's trivia game is a start.
I think they'll get some cash, but I don't think it's going to be the panacea that they think.
Weber says IMDb will need to go further, using product placement in the game or sharing user information with sites that sell movie tickets. Ken Doctor is a media analyst with OutsellInc.com. He says trivia games can pay off when you combine them with coupons and other prizes to keep players coming back. Doctor says these games marry technology with human psychology.
What do we like to do? We like to say, hey, I bet you don't remember who that actress was. Boom, right?
Yeah, it's addictive being right. Almost like
a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind.
I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, you've got no privacy. Get over it.
When I started on Facebook, it was really a personal experience. And now it's just become like this whole advertisement.
But first, let's do the numbers. The start on Wall Street was stronger than the finish, but an up day anyway. The Dow Industrials gained 1.3% today. 146 points closed at 11,190, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ advanced 1.2%, 30 points, ended at 2546. The S&P 500 picked up 1%, 12 points, ended at 11.75. Financial shares were mixed today. Morgan Stanley added more than 2%. Citigroup put on 1%. Goldman Sachs climbed 0.4% today. On the energy front, ExxonMobil advanced 1.75%. Chevron stepped up 2.25%. ConocoPhillips pocketed 0.2%. Research in Motion got moving on rumors that activist investor Carl Icahn has taken a stake in the BlackBerry maker. RIM shares recharged by nearly 4.5% today. Bonds fell just a sliver. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.97%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for August. Classrooms across the country take a break from the usual pencils and books to tune into President Obama's back-to-school speech. And Rosh Hashanah begins at sundown. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So stocks and bonds get virtually all the attention in the business press. But if you really want to go where the action is, dip a toe in the derivatives market. You remember credit default swaps, right? Those secret handshakes that 3.5 years ago brought us all closer to the apocalypse than we'd care to remember? Yeah, derivatives. Way too complicated financial contracts that multiplied and flooded markets virtually without oversight. Regulators are now fine-tuning some new rules for what's being called a derivatives clearinghouse. But what exactly does that mean? Handily, that's just the kind of question that our series Economy 4.0 was set up to answer. And so here's Marketplace's David Brancaccio.
At one point in 2009, the private market for derivatives was valued at somewhere near $600 trillion. So there were trillions of dollars worth of promises floating around the markets that turns out could not be kept. But while the author of Traders, Guns, and Money, Shutyajit Das, says that this market was largely unregulated, it's not that derivatives are inherently bad.
It's a bit like cholesterol, isn't it? Good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. It's the mix.
Das has been closely following new financial regulation that calls for a clearinghouse for these derivatives to bring more order to this vast market. These will be companies, usually private, that register with the government to act as a kind of insurance to both sides of a derivatives contract. Let's see if a metaphor can help make this clear. A pre-cana, that's the pre-wedding classes that the Catholic Church requires for couples before they walk down the aisle. Maybe a clearinghouse is like a pre-cana that helps set out the rules for a contract. So both sides, the buyer and seller of the derivative, know what to expect once they're engaged to be wed.
When you're engaged, that's when you overvalue your assets, right?
Ivanka Olesnicki, the pre-cana facilitator at a church in Newark, New Jersey, coordinates a weekend of speakers who make sure this overvaluing doesn't cause problems for young couples later on. The speakers cover budgeting, children, conflict resolution.
And some people at the end of the weekend, they'll say, oh, we're so compatible. This is really great. And some people say, wow, we have a lot of work to do.
So back to you, Mr. Das. Is a clearinghouse like a pre-cana?
The contract that you're talking about is almost like what I would call a disclosure statement, an arrangement before you enter into the contract. So basically all the risks are explained and you say, well, these are the issues that may come up. How are we going to resolve that? And then you enter into the contract of marriage.
But a clearinghouse, Das explains, doesn't care how you came to be engaged. It doesn't care about the Pinot Grigio you shared on your first date or how many kids you plan to have. All a clearinghouse is interested in is making sure that you fulfill your marriage contract once you've signed, in sickness and in health, in good times and in bad.
So another way of saying this in the context of the Catholic Church, which is divorce is generally not allowed.
Okay, so let's now try clearinghouse metaphor number two.
And they're off!
Is a clearinghouse more like the guy you call to place a bet on a racehorse, i.e. a bookie?
No, the bookie are the derivatives traders, because they're the ones taking the other side of the bet.
Okay, so we now know what a clearinghouse is not. It's not quite like a prenuptial counseling session. It's not like a bookie either.
The best way to think about the clearinghouse is the mafia and the godfather. You're a minor crook.
I'm Bruno Tartaglia.
and you enter into some contract with somebody else.
$50,000.
And the other guy looks at you and says, hey, how do I know you're going to perform this contract? And you say, well, I have a godfather.
Are you my friend? Godfather?
And you go to the godfather and say, this guy doesn't trust me. So will you ensure that if anything happens to me, that he will get paid or receive his goods or whatever? And the godfather says, of course.
Good.
Pay me the protection money.
Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service.
In the Coppola film, the godfather asks for a service to be rendered sometime in the murky future. Can our Godfather Clearinghouse metaphor extend this far?
In fact, that's a very good analogy because the whole system of risk management entails people doing certain things for the Godfather to ensure that he keeps his promise and agrees to perform in your behalf for the entire life of the contract. And that's how it works.
So there you have it. A clearinghouse, a government-sanctioned company with the means and the know-how, will act like a godfather. A system to be sure that when it comes to derivatives, folks live up to their agreements or else.
Conceptually, it's a terrific idea, but the devil, as we always know, is in the detail, and it's not an easy idea to make work.
A point recently confirmed by Commodity Futures Trading Commission Chairman Gary Gensler, who put off finalizing clearinghouse rules for derivatives until 2012 because it's also complicated. In the meantime, the rest of us can wait and watch The Godfather. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
My Facebook account was hacked a couple of months ago. I think I've mentioned it. And nothing I've done, not calling Facebook, not emailing Facebook, not complaining about Facebook on the radio, has gotten me my account back. Honestly, I don't miss it all that much. I don't have to deal with all the Facebook privacy angst. And I know full well I'm not really the target audience anyway. But Asha Richardson and Bianca Brooks are. Asha is a junior at Mills College, majoring in, as it happens, economics. Bianca is a high school student up in Oakland. Good to have you both with us.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
This is a story really about how the other half lives online, about some of these stories we've been seeing the last couple of days of privacy and how younger people who are online worry about it. And so I guess, Bianca, you're 15 years old, you're in high school. Mm-hmm. Is privacy a thing for you?
Yes, mostly because, like, when I started on Facebook and on social networking, it was really a personal experience. And now it's just become like this whole advertisement for like thousands of products that I never ask for and I would really never buy.
Yeah, you had a great line to one of my producers yesterday. You said they took the face out of Facebook.
They did take the face out of Facebook. Now it's ad book or like sell book, and it's just crazy.
Asha, you feel the same way?
I'm conflicted because the only thing that I really can't stand about the Facebook privacy issue is that they're always changing it. They don't tell you that they're changing it until after they've changed it. Like when they made the change and they just added everybody's cell phone number who had installed the Facebook app onto their phone. They didn't tell anybody. It was just there all of a sudden.
Is there anything that would make you leave Facebook or Google Plus or Twitter or whatever other social networking sites you're on, Asha?
I've actually started making the transition.
Huh.
You know, I just turned 20 and soon I'll be trying to get internships and stuff. And I don't want people to be able to Google my name and see every little thing I've ever said in the world.
So the same question that I asked Asha, I'll ask you. Would you leave Facebook or Google Plus or Twitter or any of these other sites?
It's so hard to answer that. The pros and cons, they're like weighed the same. Like it's like at one point you're losing your personal identity with people. Like people don't even know how to socially talk in real life anymore. But then at the same time, it's like it's still networking. Like it's still good for businesses. It's still good for all this stuff. If I would personally leave it, I don't really think so. Maybe one day I can just delete it, but no time soon.
Asha, you are 20. You're a junior in college. You're going to be doing job interviews soon. Is social networking something you feel you need? Do you have to be on Facebook?
Well, I actually just talked to somebody about this the other day, and they're in the MBA program, and they were like, do you have a LinkedIn? And I was like, no, I don't have a LinkedIn, because I thought that wouldn't be good. And they're like, oh, you need this one. So apparently some social networking sites are acceptable for certain age groups. I mean, I've been using computers, and like I started using Yahoo in third grade. Back in the day, in the 90s, the internet was this anonymous. The internet was this anonymous place, and now it's not that. Who you are on the internet is more like substantial than who you are in person.
Yes.
Like, I know people who would rather give you their cell phone number than add you on Facebook.
Asha Richardson and Bianca Brooks in Oakland. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Asha and Bianca came to us courtesy of Youth Radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that German Chancellor Angela Merkel met with her Greek counterpart, Prime Minister George Papandreou, today. Merkel said in basically these words that Germany will give Greece all necessary assistance. Anyway, saw a piece in the New York Times yesterday by our every now and then commentator Todd Buchholz, in which he offers as good a reason as anybody that I've seen for why the Germans will help Athens out. It's passion, plain and simple. Yeah, no, not German passion. Greek passion. Ouzo and olive oil and dancing the day away. The Germans wish they had it, so they're going to help the Greeks keep it. Made sense to me. That's Marketplace on this Tuesday from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 146 points, 1.3%, a rocky ride, actually, on some of that European news. The NASDAQ advanced 30 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 picked up 12 points. That is 1%. Thanks today to Doug Krisner, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. And that is where you can turn for the latest in business and economic news tomorrow morning, first thing. Coming up next time back here.
The money and the demand, you know, there's always going to be a job somewhere.
What professionals in Detroit do if they don't do cars. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.